I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is GeekSpeak. Today is a pleasure to have Jaafar Hussain with me. He's a colleague at Netflix, a JavaScript programmer, and general amazing developer who I've had a lot of fun watching present on stage at multiple conferences, and also doing a small in-house training seminar on observables, or RX observables, a pattern called reactive programming, which we're going to talk about in the second half of the show. This is a highly technical show in the second half. In the beginning, though, I do ask Jaafar a bit about his career and a bit about where he lives and why, and I think that's kind of interesting to a broader audience. So stick with us for as long as you can and enjoy the geek babble at the end of this program. Jaafar Hussain. Hussain, yeah?
Yeah, it's one way to pronounce it.
How do you pronounce it?
Hussain is a fine one. There's plenty of different pronunciations out there. There's no rules.
I hear people around the office refer to you as Jaafar sometimes.
Jaafar, with Aladdin, you can't blame them. I don't even think my mother doesn't pronounce my name correctly. I think my mother is a WASP and my father's Pakistani, and I think that's the thing, you just end up going with your mother's pronunciation.
She's around more.
Yeah, and some places it might be pronounced more like Jaafar or something like that with harder consonants. I just don't call me a jerk. That's all I say.
And I don't find that you are. When your user interface engineers start up at Netflix, one of the first things that happens is you invite them to a little meeting and say, hey, have you heard about RX?
Right.
RX observables. And so you kind of meet all the new UI engineers across, I think, all the platforms. How long have you been doing that?
Probably not long after I started. Probably about a year after I started Netflix here, so maybe for the last 4 or 5 years. It's been it's great in the sense that we use RX and this observable type a lot here at Netflix. So both on the server and on the client sometimes. And so in general, because it's just some technology that's just kind of ubiquitous here, we kind of think it's worthwhile training new developers. We don't do a lot of training here at Netflix, as you know, Lyle.
We hire senior people.
Yeah, we hire senior people. I think this is an area where certainly 5 years ago, where we were kind of, I think, early to this to this game of reactive programming as far as the industry goes. Not the first, but certainly early.
And I guess at this point, if you've been a serious developer, you know about reactive programming at some level. You might not have done it, but you know about it. Yeah,
the landscape's really changed over the last 5 years. And so increasingly we get people walking through the door who either are, fluent or at least have a passing familiarity with observable. And it's been interesting to see it cross platforms as well. So, I think folks on the web were certainly early adopters. In .NET, there was a few early adopters. It's actually become quite big in Android land now, in so much as – so the recent Android architecture components that came out interact directly with the observables if you happen to have RX Java 2 running. So it's interesting to kind of see it every couple of years that some new platform discovers it and starts using it.
I hear a lot about RX Swift on the Apple devices.
RX Swift is a big deal too.
Let's go ahead and talk a little bit about living in Silicon Valley and living in San Francisco specifically, because you commute via shuttle.
I do every day. Yeah.
And what's it? Why settle in San Francisco? Why are you doing that?
That's a great question. There's a lot of controversy, I think, about tech commuters. Certainly in the city, and particularly the city in which I live, the Mission. It's a very controversial subject, and I think in San Francisco as a whole. The reason I live in San Francisco is simple. My individual incentives, I think, are quite easy to understand for most people who have lived in larger urban cities like myself. I grew up and spent most of my formative years in Toronto, which is one of the fourth largest cities in North America. One of the things about Toronto is diversity and the other experiences that come from, city life, urban living.
Yeah.
I wanted to try and recapture that as best as I could wherever I went. And I, before coming here to San Francisco, I stayed in Seattle for a while. And Seattle is not a big city the way Toronto is.
Yeah.
And it also, while being actually surprisingly highly multicultural, there's not a lot of the neighborhoods are very there's a word specifically, it's escaping me for a moment here, but there's a lot of multiculturalism.
Homogeneous
neighborhoods, kind of? Exactly. You get these homogeneous neighborhoods. And I really miss the fact that in Toronto, things bleed together actually quite a bit much more. And so I wanted to get that sense by moving into the Mission in San Francisco.
And have you gotten that?
I absolutely have. I mean, the Mission is a fantastic place to live in terms of you have, a lot of the – a lot of different cultures out there.
Yeah.
And that's really what I appreciated about living in the city. I love it. I'm not sure I'm loved. And I think there's maybe a lot of people.
And that's because, of course, the Silicon Valley aspect of your high pay compared to most people in San Francisco kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Or, yeah.
I'm certain that what's going on is that gentrification is raising rents in the area.
Yeah.
I'm keenly aware of this. I
didn't mean to surprise you on this
touchy
subject.
Fine, yeah.
But it's one of those things that, you know, I live, you know, in the boonies of Santa Cruz Mountains, and so I'm not in that same kind of scenario. Of course, the increases in house prices all over this area have gone up quite a bit. But it's not like the touchstone it is in San Francisco with the density of people that are highly affected. And you live right in the heart of it and live there really intentionally because of being in a city. And so I just want to get your take on it. What is it that you like about the multicultural aspect of living in a, you know, in a dense, diverse environment? Why?
Even my high school in Toronto, being such an incredibly multicultural place, my high school is over half non-white. And that just became normal to me and desirable. And then, you know, in certain times of my life, I've been living in areas where you just don't have that same multiculturalism. And I guess for me, it's you know, walking down the street in the Mission and going through an art gallery or art installation, and then three blocks later, having a Latin jazz band playing, and then four blocks later, stumbling on a street festival. That's the type of, you know, kind of experience that to me, I think – you know, I think of it as an American experience, despite the fact that, Canada obviously is very multicultural as well, right? To me, this is the thing that I love about America and is historically, obviously, it's been so welcoming to immigrants, and that has, you know, kind of made it such an interesting place. And so I think San Francisco is a great microcosm for that idea. I don't know. It's not representative of America as a whole, right? I'm well aware of that. But it's something about being exposed to all that diversity.
Yeah.
It's something that I grew up with, and so I kind of cherish that.
Yeah, diversity of people, but it sounds a lot like that broad spectrum of art and music and food kind of mixes with that. If you bring a whole bunch of different people in, you get a lot of aspects of our creativity displayed.
Yeah, I mean,
engaging.
For me, honestly, I think in some ways, while I'm not tremendously creative myself, you know, I feel like I'm so left-brained for most of my career. I've been doing such work that, while granted, software development requires right-brain thinking.
Sure.
But, you know, it's not like the arts, right? And so sometimes I feel like so left-brained as though that my head tilts slightly to the left as I'm walking around. You know, because I don't get a lot of time to engage in very creative pursuits, I love to kind of absorb it by osmosis and kind of, you know.
When did you first grab a computer and start fiddling on a keyboard?
You know, quite late as far as many software developers are concerned. I think I was about – I would have been in grade 10. My first exposure to computers was actually at that high school, which was an incredibly well-funded high school in Toronto, where we had incredible resources as far as computer labs were concerned. We had like a high school computer programming course, which wasn't very normal all those years ago. I often wonder, you know, would I have actually gotten into software? A lot of people, you know, they get the Commodore 64, they
Commodore VIC-20 right over here.
Right, yeah. And then they start kind of hacking away at it. I didn't really get that exposure. I did have an Amiga, which I never really tried to hack, which I really enjoyed. My mother was kind enough to, you know, get me a great computer for home.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until they took an actual computer programming course that
So how did you get hooked into a computer? Were you good in math and that's why you went to computer?
No, I wouldn't say. I mean, I was, you know, average in math. For me, it was probably Doom. Doom was the first time that I was actually forced to tinker with my computer.
Because you needed to get it to perform.
Exactly. I was running a 386SX. I needed to use a boot disk to avoid booting Windows. And then I got into batch programming, just ever so slightly into batch file programming. And then I didn't have very much time doing that until...
This is just to load drivers and get the game working. And Doom, of course, is kind of the go-to first-person shooter. First first-person shooter that's kind of a 3D, even though it's not really 3D, game.
Yeah. And it got me that... So I had to do a little bit of programming to obviously get Doom to perform. But then that's what really... It was also Doom itself. And I'm sure, you know, this is a very common tale, but I'm sure it was Doom itself, which was just magical at the time. I think it's
another world.
Absolutely. It was just a formative kind of experience. That just made me curious how something, you know, so immersive could possibly be created. And that's what really got me curious about the man behind the curtain, you know, going under the hood.
The thing that was interesting about Doom was, like, we were seeing in immersive computer games in consoles at Atari, you know, arcade systems. We'd go there. But, of course, you spent money to do that. So it was kind of like this appliance thing that you went to visit. Like you'd go to a movie theater. It wasn't something you owned. It wasn't something that was, you could understand it in the level. It was just there, and you'd take your money and you'd spend some time on it. But when it was on your personal computer, it became this different thing. It's like, oh, this computer can sometimes not do that and then sometimes do it by my own command. And then in a situation where you want to get your graphics card fast enough to render the frames quickly, you're kind of starting to tinker and you're understanding, oh, this is a machine that I can pull the levers on, which is an edifying experience rather than a standalone console that is a black box.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely hooked from Hello World. Yeah. It was something that I was very fortunate from very early in my – I think people can, you know, you can underestimate how important this is. From very early in my career, you know, I knew what I wanted to do, and that allowed me to kind of zero in and focus.
After that 10th grade computer course, you're like, oh, yeah, this is it.
I had a laser focus. Okay.
So at that point in that class, I'm assuming you did extremely well in that class. Was it from there on out you just did as much as possible on the computer?
Yeah, I hewed heavily. And there's times actually – it's funny now with perspective alluding to what I was talking about earlier. This time, you know, I wonder at this point in my life, you know, looking back, maybe I wish I'd done more balance – had a more balanced education instead of leaning so heavily towards computing. And that's kind of, you know, ties things back to why I love, you know, living in an area where there's artists and, you know, there's kind of artistic pursuits.
Because you miss so much of it focused on the screen.
I mean, you know, I feel like this, I'm actually only gaining more of an appreciation of these things as I get a little more time and a little more distance now from computing.
Yeah. I recall when I first started doing like web development right before 2000, in the 98 or so, and I recall going, oh, anybody could do this. And over time, I've realized, oh, no, I spent so much time learning those things that, you know, you put those 2,000 hours in easy, 20,000 hours, whatever it is, over time, you don't notice it because it's almost like it's driven by some passion, like a person that's, you know, doodling on the piano and just plays and plays and plays and plays. And I find that what's interesting, if I balance back my life when I got into computers, I definitely put aside other things in my life. And I would say that I'm not as excellent a programmer as I'd want to be because I do have other interests. I do other things as well. You have an expertise level that's very respected around the office. How much did you sacrifice on going to dances or backpacking? Like other activities that friends and people that would have been friends if you spent time with them, how much did you sacrifice on that, on getting to be an expert in computers?
You know, it's funny. I don't remember sacrificing that much socially. I certainly, you know, there wasn't as though I was, you know, not going out with friends camping so I could stay home and code. I would say that it was more about sucking up the oxygen for other pursuits in life outside the social, just like, you know, as I age, I'm becoming more interested in design and obviously that's adjacent to the work we do, what with working in user interfaces. But, you know, it wasn't so much that, but it was that I didn't feel like I was losing out just because I was enjoying it so much. And I would say, though, that, you know, for a long period of my life, you know, it was every day, whether I was working or not, was spent coding. And so while I'm sure I did probably miss out on some things, you know, it's not something that I have given that much thought to. I guess at my age, I think we've all – there's been, you know, people are talking about the fact that in the modern age, people are reporting fewer and fewer close friends. Mm-hmm. And so I myself have, you know, probably a handful of close friends that I really confide in. So I don't feel, you know, bereft socially. I actually don't feel like I need that many really close friends in my inner circle. I feel like you only need a few, really.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't really feel like I missed out socially, but more about being a more well-rounded individual, you know, learning more about design, learning more about exploring things that I really enjoyed in minors, you know, like philosophy.
Right.
I really dropped those.
And that's so one of those things that you put yourself in an environment that has lots to grow in. Helps that, right? Because all of a sudden you can't but notice the jazz band that's playing down the street and engage in that and go, oh, this is something that I want to enjoy. Did you do any sports?
Yeah, I mean, it was Canada. So, you know, I played hockey. That was the law back then.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and so there was some hockey for a while. I wasn't a star or anything by any means. And then a lot of road hockey, very disorganized sports, very disorganized. But, you know, I mean, basketball, too. I love basketball. We had a net in my backyard. But, you know, I wouldn't say I was like a big into a team league kind of guy.
So in college, did you major in computer science?
So I got a Bachelor of Tech, which was a way of actually going from a – so initially I went to college, which in Canada is more like a trade. Effectively, what I was trying to do was get into the industry as quickly as possible, primarily because we were in the middle of the dot-com boom.
Yeah.
And so there was a gold rush This was back when they were, you know, handing huge checks to anybody who put HTML on their resume. And so I wanted to get into the industry as quickly as possible, and I didn't want to wait, you know, three years for a bachelor.
I did the same thing. You know, as soon as I could be employed, I was employed.
Yeah, yeah, and then the dot-com bubble burst, mm-hmm. and I thought, great, good opportunity to go back and get my education. So thankfully they allowed me to take my my experience in the college and then actually leverage that up. And so I only had to do a year additionally above that experience to get a bachelor. And then I went to work for the Canadian Cancer Society in Toronto.
What did you do for them?
That was a lot of web development. It was full stack development, yeah. right? It was web development, but it was also, you know, this was in the time where you had to be jack of all trades.
Sure,
and to some degree,
sure.
of course, it's still true.
Yeah,
but
no,
things were less specialized. And right. so
but you were running the database and you were running
exactly,
the servers
right. yep.
and making sure there's load balancing and all that.
Yeah.
And basically making the Cancer Society be online and accessible, I'm assuming, is what you were doing.
Yeah. Well, so let's see. Jeez, it's been a long time.
We don't necessarily have to dive down into that if there's not interesting stories in that. But I'm just
I don't think there was that many interesting stories. I mean, it was, you know, me as a junior developer – getting a sense of – probably I guess the most interesting aspect to that would be just my first experience of pain points around data. And that was actually a really important experience for me. It was understanding that I could build what I thought was a really – you know, for a junior developer, what I misguidedly thought was a really nice, clean architecture. And then as soon as data became involved, it fell over and it became very ugly and painful. And so that was a really important experience for me because I realized how difficult it was to integrate against a relational database when you'd been taught for a lot of my courses had focused on object-oriented programming. I think it's fair to say that I had a Java school style education.
Okay.
Lots of talk has been, you know, put into Java school. So we didn't learn functional programming mm-hmm. in my university. It was focused on C++. It was focused on Java.
Yeah.
And so
object-oriented programming modeling.
Yeah, yeah. And I spent a huge amount of time thinking about every type of problem, seeing if I could think about what the canonical object-oriented solution to that problem might be.
I recall this pattern of trying to put everything in objects.
Right.
Yep.
But then, of course, I would integrate with this relational world, which I didn't understand as well. I mean, we definitely did, you know, covered SQL databases, but not at the formalism of like relational calculus, right?
Yeah.
I there was this weird thing that I wanted to think about in terms of objects. I thought, oh, well, tables, rows are kind of like objects. And so but of course, as everyone knows, there's a real impedance mismatch between the concepts in relational calculus and object-oriented programming. It's not straightforward. A row isn't an object, and there are, you know, it's those differences that cause tremendous friction when I was trying to build a program.
Let's talk about really simple relational data models, so we can clarify what's problematic in it.
There's a couple of interesting things when you look at relational systems and hierarchical systems. So we're object-oriented programming. A couple of interesting observations, anyways, which is that in a relational system, you have parents that know about their children. And so we've all seen that kind of foreign key relationship as you work with SQL databases. So I have a movie an episode, for example, mm-hmm. right, which is within a show. Now, the episode will have a foreign key, which is the show ID, for example, that references a show table.
Okay. So we're talking about Orange is the New Black and episode one of Orange is the New Black.
Yeah,
so episode one knows it's part of Orange is the New Black.
Yes, it knows about its parent.
Yeah.
But if you look at a lot of object-oriented systems, it's actually the reverse. You have a show with a collection of – with a list of episodes, and it's the show that knows about the episode and not vice versa.
Oh, interesting.
So these are just some interesting observations about the differences,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then inheritance relationships are challenging to model in relational systems. There's a variety of different – there's a variety of different options yeah. you can go with, but you know, none of them are fit quite perfectly, right? They all have different trade-offs, right? Let's say I have an inheritance relationship of a human being, which is a Netflix user, and so on and so forth. And you can have this inheritance relationship. How do I model that in tables? Do I put it in one table and then have a bunch of fields that are null?
A type field that kind of –
right,
yeah.
with a type discriminator field, which is
right.
one of the patterns.
Yeah.
Do I put
That's
it
Rails
into –
Rails is patterned for doing that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other, you can also put it into separate tables. You can have one table for each type And then you could have a similar to the inheritance relationship, the way you might think of a V table to be structured.
Yep.
You can have all the base class fields in one table and then a foreign key to the expanded
row.
Kind
of model it that way. Right. Yeah.
But, you know, operations that are inexpensive, like in order to do something like that, operations that are inexpensive and kind of downcasting, for example, can be expensive when you think about them relationally. Like, well, I'm going to load all these fields, but, you know, 60% of the time or 60% of those fields might be null for this entity. And that's expensive, right? And
I
have to load them now because I don't want to make, say, 2 round trips, for example, or, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and actually, I'm not sure that's probably not the biggest problem you see with object relational mapping. One of the biggest problems I think you see is the N plus one query problem, the way in which people think about loading data from a SQL database, where you think about loading in a single batch of data,
right,
versus the way in which you kind of are able to progressively navigate down a hierarchy when you're walking an object tree.
Right. So an object tree, for example, is that Orange is the New Black show. You've got an object that's a show, and then it has a list of episodes. And each of those are instantiated as episode objects, which have properties like maybe actors and directors, but also have titles and descriptions and such. And so when you're thinking about it that way, when you say in your web page or something and you say, hey, render a list of these episodes, you're kind of handing off these objects that are everything that Vue needs to do to render a display that would make sense.
Yep.
At the same time, to load any of that, you kind of have to load all of it, because the show is not the complete show object if it doesn't have all the episode children. And that starts becoming kind of a problem at a larger scale in being practical to load all that. And, of course, transfer all that data. So you're learning this about this kind of impedance mismatch as you're seeing lots of data from the – what is it called? The Canadian Cancer Society? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in that situation, you start running into, oh, there's a problem here. First kind of twinkling that there might be an issue.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, there's so many patterns for kind of integrating against a relational database. But as soon as you the idea here, of course, with objects is you want routines that only know about the data that they operate on, right? But as soon as you bring data access into that, which is fundamentally a very expensive operation, right? Every time I access data, it's expensive. The challenge
is – whether it's from a database or a local – from a remote resource of some sort.
Yeah. I mean, what a lot of object relational mappers would do is they would basically take your object model. They would generate you a series of classes, and those classes would be like proxies, mm-hmm. such that they would lazily load things when you asked for a property, mm-hmm. which basically abstracts over the data access. So I get an object and then I loop over all of the entities in its say list of, you know, list of entities. And then in the worst case scenario, as I loop over each one of these, it could be issuing an individual query for one. Now, most do better than that. Like, yep. They might say, oh, as soon as you start iterating a list, I'm going to go and get all those items. But then, you know, who knows, if I iterate the first 2 items in that list, maybe I, you know, you didn't need to go and load the entire collection.
Right.
And so the way in which I thought of object-oriented programming is, and I had a function which accepts a particular type, and that's all it really needs to know about, didn't really turn out to be true, because I needed to have more knowledge than I wanted, which is, what is this routine actually going to be doing? Because if I can have some knowledge about that ahead of time, I could go and load all of that data up front and then save myself multiple round trips.
Right.
And so that's
when you see this kind of thing in Rails is the first time I actually ran into a situation where we had object mapping like this. And you definitely see the models get relatively complex in how you build up the data, right? The model of the show has to know about the details of an episode so that it can make sure to get the director of that episode when it actually gets an episode. So you're spanning multiple tables. And so you start kind of building that understanding of selecting data at a level that's completely disassociated to what the source of that or the user of that data is, that episode. So it does have that kind of mess in some sense. And it is the thing that once you get past the, you know, hello world of an application, a database web application like this, you start seeing this kind of emerge. And if you don't, you start seeing serious performance hits, lots of database queries, for example.
Right. And so the danger would be that I would get up and running very quickly. I was very happy with the system.
Yeah.
And then the DBA would give me a super hard time, correct?
The database administrator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hitting him with so much traffic for something that really should have been one query. And that's really when I began to understand. At the time, I hated databases because, of course, I'd been taught about object-oriented programming and this was the right way to think about this problem.
Right, right.
And so I thought, oh, well, databases are doing it wrong. And so gradually, and outside of an academic setting, I started to immerse myself and started to try and understand the root of this problem, right?
Right.
Why was this so hard? I mean, you know, I was just trying to persist data and load it? Why was this forcing me to actually change fundamentally the way in which I approached the program? Mm-hmm. And it's through this pain that I was exposed to more programming paradigms, really on my own, to try and understand the root of this problem and try and, frankly, return to some semblance of code that I found elegant, that I found satisfying.
Right. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak. I'm speaking with Jaffer Hussain, who's a developer with me at Netflix. Jaffer sits on the TC39, which kind of helps define what the next versions of JavaScript is. And they have a lot of conversations, and it's an industry board that kind of, well, produces what JavaScript will turn into, which is really kind of exciting. As a web developer for a long time, JavaScript was a very static thing that didn't change very much. And it's neat seeing the change of the language. Okay, so you start learning about other paradigms out of school. You see the collision of what you learn from object-oriented programming into this real-world case where you had lots of data flowing over the wire with a DBA going, hey, you're not doing this right, and seeing a mismatch. And so you start looking at, I'm assuming, functional programming.
I didn't really have any conception of functional programming, but not a very, very basic introduction in an academic setting. And so it was more that I was introduced to functional programming through my use of the .NET framework. Mm-hmm. And so the .NET framework, is for those of you who aren't aware, I mean, you can think of it as Microsoft's answer to Java, which I think that's probably very reductive today. But back then, it actually wasn't very reductive. It was very much JavaScript. Microsoft's reaction to a lawsuit with Sun, and they said, okay, well, we're going to build our own thing. And it was heavily inspired, I think it's fair to say, by Java. But during a period there, after the Canadian Cancer Society, I worked in the .NET stack. I would have been at... forgetting my own career here, where would I have gone after that? I went to an advertising agency for a short period of time, say 8 months. But they were using .NET pretty intensively. And I'd used .NET in my first co-op in mm-hmm. university. I'd also used .NET at Canadian Cancer Society on the server side. That was basically what I'd kind of – that was my stack at the time. Yeah, I was definitely a Microsoft guy. And then in 2008 or so there was a fellow who I came to be aware of called Eric Meyer. He was an architect over at Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And he'd written a white paper called Circles, Triangles, and Squares. And, I tried to read a lot of white papers. I was trying to learn more, again, try and make up for what I lacked in my academic education. And I stumbled upon this paper and I thought, my God, this guy is absolutely describing the problem that I have and what's been frustrating me for, most of my career doing kind of full stack development. And the premise was that objects are circles, tables are squares, and triangles are XML documents, which at the time, XML was the rage.
Right. It's equivalent to JavaScript, JSON now. It's the data transport layer with text-based, and you can transfer it anywhere you want.
Yeah, except XML had even more impedance mismatches, weird concepts that were nothing really like – that didn't have really good analogs in object-oriented programming. And he sort of said, look, I mean, a lot of the code that developers write nowadays is really dedicated to changing representations of data from these three forms. Uh-huh. So why don't we just introduce concepts into the language – that allow – actually bring the concepts of SQL, bring the concepts of XML into the language, and that will make this plumbing code of
a lot easier.
Changing data representations much easier.
Can you just do a quick breakdown of what functional programming actually is?
Yeah. So that's a surprisingly controversial – that can be a controversial definition. Probably the most boring and correct response would be to say that it's something that's very similar to the lambda calculus, which was formalized – by Alonzo Church, and this is how you could a model of computation that could be accomplished using just functions. And so he showed that you could compute anything that could be computed using functions. And this was sort of, this was found to be equivalent to the work that Turing was doing around his Turing machines. And you can, in a lot of ways, you can say that these are two systems that are isomorphic, which can both anything that can be computed in one can be computed in the other, but both of these kind of foundations of computation have led us in very, very different directions. The Turing machine, this way of thinking of a computer, is a very stateful machine where you're kind of spinning in a loop and you're changing state, and it kind of whirs and pops, this little machine, and it eventually produces the right answer. Really allowed us to think about computation often at the level of the hardware And as a result, we tended to use that a lot, and we've been using that for most commercial applications.
And would you say that object-oriented programming came out of that idea?
Object-oriented programming is really an evolution of imperative procedural programming. And so it's still very much in the concept of a Turing machine. I'm going to modify some state, and state's going to change all over the place. It was, you know, object-oriented programming. Again, there's another controversial definition.
Sure.
You know, you talk to some people, and they say it's fundamentally about just message passing. That's what Alan Kay, I believe, said, that it's just about one object sending a message to another. Right? And presumably that object would often respond by changing its state. But a lot of the concepts that have been associated with object-oriented programming today have kind of been, you know, some people like the original coiner of the phrase, I think it was Alan Kay, I could be wrong about that, you know, he's kind of sworn off. He said, look, there's a lot more that's been associated with object-oriented programming in the vein of Java than I really intended. I really just wanted this ability of message passing between objects. But it's still in the vein of imperative programming. Mm-hmm. And because that's the vast majority of commercial programming has been done in this concept of imperative, you know, programming, I would say, for the most part. And think about things like C, obviously. C and Java and all of the little subtle incremental evolution and evolutionary jumps between these languages, right?
Are all going down that Turing pattern of lots of store state, check state.
Exactly.
Modify.
With increasingly elaborate abstractions on top of that, but nothing really changing that fact.
Okay. And the other path?
Yeah, the other path is this kind of this mathematical system about thinking about computation, defined in terms of functions, and it's absolutely beautiful. If you can find some time to look up things like the Y Combinator or these very simple kind of, I guess depending on your perspective, simple ways in which you can represent all of computation, right? With a simple, how do you take a function which has no name and set it up to be recursive, because it has no name. How can it call itself, right? And
right.
So these are things that mathematicians worked out. They figured out how to just take in JavaScript, this would be, you can think of the
closure.
Think of the arrow function,
okay.
Right? The arrow function, and you know how would you get an arrow function to be recursive, right? Just an expression, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's tricks like that they worked out. They're just so incredibly beautiful. That I've come to, come to be aware of only much later in life after my academic career, and I started exploring functional programming. And I thought to myself, my God, I've been missing so much of the story here. And I really, to some degree, felt let down by my education in that respect. Because, although to be fair, I think they were trying very hard to prepare me for the world of commercial software development at that time.
Sure, which was Java.
Yeah, it absolutely was.
And when you were dealing with .NET at the company after the Cancer Society, mm-hmm. why was it easier to do functional programming in that rather than Java?
So, sorry, I've left out a whole career here.
Sure.
Between Cancer Society and the marketing, I went to work for GE. And so I worked on .NET most heavily there.
Okay.
And I was helping them build engineering systems, basically systems for costing water treatment systems, and at the time, you know, I was way less focused on what I was doing, specifically the problem I was solving, rather than honing on my craft. I was actually just desperate for a problem so I could hone my craft and think about how to solve and model problems as elegantly as possible. And at the time, I had the same pain point, right? We were integrating against a relational database, and it was very frustrating. And this paper, Circles, Triangles, and Squares, basically put together a little variant of the C# language, which is sort of like Java on top of on top of .NET. It's the language that people use in .NET.
C#.
And there was a variant of the language, kind of an experimental one. I remember downloading it and playing around with it. And the idea was to bring SQL, like the query language, directly into the programming language.
Mm-hmm.
And I just experimented with that. I knew I couldn't use it in production, but I was able to experiment against it with a live system. And I was just shocked. I thought, my God, this is, you know, the right way to think about these problems. When I'm doing data transformation, I will use a query because that's something very well suited. At the time, I didn't really have a conception that this was functional programming per se.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that increasingly, because this is what I do, I think, with all new tech, so to speak, or new concepts or new idioms, you just try and use them as much as possible. You overuse them, and that's why that's how you understand their boundaries, right?
Yeah.
That's where you're exploring, hey, I've gone too far. But gradually, I began to notice that I was able, the more code I wrote, the more I realized that I could turn a lot of the code I was writing into queries. And so if you looked at my C# code, it looked like a lot of SQL, which I'm not necessarily recommending, but I was interested to know that it could be done. And so as I continued to unwind the stack and realize that, well, okay, I'll use this query for this little bit of logic right here, like hunting for the first item in a list that matches some condition.
Mm-hmm.
Then I thought to myself, well, actually, this function itself that I'm calling could really be made part of a query because I'm in the end – almost the entire space of my code where I was taking some input and computing some output and not modifying state, I realized that actually I could express that as a query. And it was tremendously readable, much more so than a nest of for loops, at least in my opinion, much more so than a nest of for loops.
So one way of thinking of this is instead of having a model of the show and the episodes, if you want to know how many people are in episode 7 of Orange is the New Black, what actors are in that, you instead would have a function that would be like get user
from persons in or from movies in show, etc. I mean, it's really just SQL. If anybody's familiar with SQL, but this was SQL that was integrated into the program.
The important thing wasn't you weren't loading all the data necessary for the show and all the data for all the episodes. You're getting just the names of the actors in episode whatever.
Well,
so it was a different way of constructing the data request.
Well, so this was when it was a research project. Mm-hmm. And within a year, I think, roughly, it was actually productionized and it was added to the C# language. And in the process, they went beyond what the paper proposed. And this was Anders Helsberg. I'm taking a lot of inspiration from Eric's ideas, and Eric was involved as well, I'm sure, who was the architect of C#. He brought these concepts into the language, and it was revelatory because going beyond just bringing concepts like SQL into the language, and that research project really wasn't about accessing remote data. It was just saying, hey, look, you can take objects and turn them into rows or turn them into XML directly using this query language. It all runs in memory.
Okay.
It was an in proc execution. But when it was released, they did something amazing, which was they took that trick of expressing queries in your code and they added the ability to convert basically to avoid compiling those queries and instead to simply parse them and keep the abstract syntax tree at runtime. And the idea was that you could simply remote that AST over to the SQL database at runtime. So it looked like you were writing a query that ran in proc, but what happened was the compiler actually parsed it, converted it into an AST, and then at runtime.
AST stands for?
Abstract syntax tree. Basically, is it, like a DOM for your code, right?
Okay.
You parse through the code and you create a DOM that represents how your code looks. But the idea there is to avoid evaluating it on the machine and instead to put it into a form where you can send it to a remote server and evaluate it, in this case, evaluate it on the database.
So you took the
server.
XML abstraction of what the data was, the object model abstraction of what the data was, and the database abstraction of the data model, and make a uniform language that is then put in memory so you can transform between all three of those relatively easily because the base is a shared experience.
Yeah, let me tweak that and just say simply that imagine you're writing a query that pulls all the movies with a rating of 5 out of that are recommended from you, right, out of the data structure that holds your Netflix recommendations, right? It'll work if it's just an in-memory set of objects, as we've discussed, a hierarchical tree of objects. But another thing that could be done is instead of compiling that query into a function, instead the C# compiler would take a look at that query and just parse it, put it into a tree so that some other algorithm could then go at runtime, look at it, and then transform it, really compile it, into another representation, i.e. a SQL query.
Okay.
And then remote the SQL query off to the server, and then it basically looks as though it's running in memory, but it's not.
Nice.
And so what they did was they mastered this importance of the three dimensions of data. The what, the where, and the when, right? And so the what, the query, was an incredible tool for allowing you to express what. What data do you want? It was this very, very easy to understand, fluent API. But then by transforming that code into data at runtime, they gave you flexibility about the where. Where was the code actually executed?
Right.
You as a developer were able to be abstracted away from this. And then at runtime, the system could make an intelligent decision about where to run the logic. So this solved one of those big problems about, well, it's more efficient if you run your code closer to the data, but it's easier to bring data closer to the code than it is send code to data. Because when you send code across the wire, there's all sorts of issues that come up with that. They solved that problem. They said, well, instead of downloading the entire database and then running your query locally in memory, let's just take your query, this code, and let's turn it into a SQL query and then send the code closer to the data.
Yeah.
And so that, and then the last dimension is really the when, right? When do I get this data? Do I stop the world and wait until the whole thing is finished processing and then I get the data and my program resumes? Or can I get this data later on? Can I express it at a high level that at some point I kind of want this data, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then allow my program to suspend and then resume and not block.
When the data comes back.
And it was that last piece that didn't come for until I was actually working at Microsoft. When I saw that work that was that had been done in the C# language, I was absolutely in awe. I thought it was some of the most exciting, certainly the most exciting tech to make it into an enterprise programming language. That was what was so exciting about this, right? I mean, I'd played with experimental languages and, you know, it's played with not just experimental languages, languages that are, you know, popular, but at the time were still niche, like ML, and I'd gotten really excited about them. But I thought, you know, well, that's cool. We all do that, right? We play with fun tech in our spare time, and then we go to work and it's a grind and we use the boring stuff. And I was shocked that they'd had the courage and the innovate, you know, that they were able to innovate such tech and then had the courage to put it into a language that was an enterprise language. And then I just set about using it intensively, and eventually I got so excited by it, I thought, well, this is really what I want to do. I want to be close to where this exciting programming language innovation is happening. And that's when I decided to make the jump to Microsoft.
Okay. So you go to Microsoft, you start working there. We are close. I mean, we're over the halfway point. We haven't even started talking about JavaScript and the new features of JavaScript, which I definitely want to talk with you about because you do sit on the TC39. So can we talk a little bit about your experience with going into Rx and where Rx emerged or when you started using it as a continuation of this same – I don't know if it's a continuation.
Well, it actually is. Yeah. It's the next step. That's the win that I alluded to earlier.
Okay.
After I joined Microsoft, I trumped up some excuse to go talk to Eric. I wasn't working with Eric. I was working in a team. This was a sort of a lateral team. It was a Silverlight team. It was focused on UI, still a UI focus. But I was just enthralled by Link and the work that Eric had done. And I found some excuse to go talk to him. What I basically did was I showed that you could take this query syntax of his and you could use it for, say, asynchronous unit testing. So you could use it to assemble. We had the problem in the UI. We had – often we would once components would render, only some information would become post-render with a component. And when we ran unit tests, we wanted to scoop up that information after it rendered. But that required us to write asynchronous unit tests. And at the time, the state of the art was – well, we used timing, and that meant we got all sorts of, you know.
So you'd just say, hey, test, wait 10 seconds.
Exactly.
And then it would be there. I mean, yes. That's not very efficient. What we'd really want to do is once the data emerges, I want to know about it so that I can then continue on my test. A unit test basically is just a simple program that tests the program you've written.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine that – just imagine a function which takes a whole bunch of lambdas that act like statements – sorry, a whole bunch of arrow functions that act like statements, and it just puts like a 100-millisecond timer in between them. This was the best – you know, this was something we trumped up really quick, right? And of course, worse than being slow, we got we got false failures, and that's really painful. And so I thought to myself, well, you know, if we can create a system that's declarative, that actually is event driven, because we'll get an event when the render occurs, then we can, you know, write this literal style. And it turns out that the syntax, without going into too much technical detail, the syntax in C# was actually extensible. So instead of just using it at the time, which was query iterable. So it was a syntax designed to query anything that was iterable. So a list or a set or anything like that. It was even more flexible than that.
Iterable means give me one, now give me the next one, now give me the next
one.
And I'm kind of controlling going through a list of things, like an episode list of a show or something.
Right, where you're pulling one item out at a time. Right. And so
you're in control of that.
Yeah. And that's why the syntax was so powerful, because almost every collection was iterable. All of a sudden, everything in the standard library could be queried using this powerful query syntax. But it turned out that they made it even more generic than that, in the sense that you could make it work by implementing some interfaces effectively. You could make it work over any type that you designed. It was really at its heart just a way of composing any type together in a high level.
So it didn't have to be necessarily a list. It could be anything that you could get more data from.
Like an asynchronous test. You can think of an asynchronous test as a promise that returned true or false. And that's effectively what I used it to compose together. I said, look, I'm going to take some function that returns a promise, and I'm going to compose all these things together into another function that returns a promise that either true or false or error potentially. Mm-hmm. More likely error, right, that you threw when you got a failing unit test. And so I showed it to him, and he said, well, that's really interesting. I showed this to Eric.
Eric Meyer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he said, well, that's really interesting, but I've actually been working on something that I think subsumes this, and it's actually, I think, a lot more flexible and powerful. And that's when he showed me this concept of the observable, which was really just Eric taking the iterable and kind of turning it inside out. And I think most people are kind of familiar with this by now, but as we said earlier with the iterable, right, the iterator, it's a consumer – pulling values from a consumer one item at a time. All right. So it's the consumer's in control. He says, hey, producer, give me the next value. And the observable, the difference there is instead of the consumer saying, hey, producer, give me the next value, instead the consumer hands the producer a callback and the producer pushes values to the consumer whenever values become available. And so it's still a way of getting one item after the other progressively over time. But the difference is with the observable, it's push and the producer's in control.
And this makes sense for a lot of different situations in computer science where if you have an iteration process, you have to have a loop where you continually check, is the value change, is the value change, is the value change. But if you have a event-driven situation where, for example, a person has moved their mouse and you get an event saying, hey, this is moved, this is moved, this is moved, instead of getting that event as a generic thing, you can compose what you want to run when that event fires and you say, hey, whenever that mouse moves, run this little bit of code. And what effectively that means is that you are told you are pushed this change all the time. And that's the observable pattern. So Eric does this at Microsoft. You're there at the same time and engaging in it. Does this change fundamentally how you think about software development?
I mean, this was the second time that Eric blew my mind in the space of 3 years, right? Yeah. And so I thought to myself, I can use this to just – basically what this meant is instead of querying these inert data structures that are sitting in memory, I could now query events. And so that's really what it was, just all the power in which I learned to query data that was there right now, right, could now be used to query events that might happen over time. Mm-hmm. And it didn't really fundamentally change the way in which I wrote the code, but it gave me this incredible tool with which to build something that was rapidly becoming more and more interesting, which was non-blocking event-driven systems.
Sure.
Right. And so as people tried to scale up on the web servers, this was becoming increasingly event-driven servers. People were realizing that there was some, you know, there was definitely for certain applications, there was some real efficiency gains to being written to writing event-driven servers.
Yep.
We've only seen that grow more and more in the industry sense, right? Node.js.
And even in the browser, people use very complicated applications in the browser. A great example of, you know, a high-level, really complicated browser application is Gmail. A lot of people use Google Mail. That application is a very complicated application, which is mostly running in one thread and doesn't feel like that. And some pretty impressive things to be able to do that. And that all is related, is using asynchronous paradigms, which JavaScript at its core is kind of built that way at some level. Okay, so at some point you leave Microsoft, you're coming here, and this is one of the reasons why you kind of made before RX and observable patterns were really kind of a fundamental thing that senior developers already knew or were aware of. You were kind of introducing people and kind of spreading the word of it. We use RX a lot here on the Groovy side, which is our backend Java side, and also our new JavaScript infrastructure, which is coming online slowly, and of course in TV and also in website client applications. So it's kind of RX is kind of commonly used by all of us now, and that RX is a library that does reactive programming, observable patterns and things. So at some point, though, you also join the TC39 and start fundamentally looking at language, the JavaScript language, what could be improved upon. And some things that have come out in JavaScript more recently, async await, which is an interesting way of describe async await. It's different in how you normally would think about callbacks and asynchronous programming.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to discuss it as another concurrency coordination, because there's not one way to do concurrency coordination. There's a lot of different approaches to concurrency coordination. There's communicated sequential processes. There is observable promises, which are very similar. And there's this kind of very fundamental concept, though, which you can use to implement some of those things, which is really interesting, called a coroutine. And for those of you who use JavaScript, generators are a great example of a coroutine. But the idea is, think of it as I'm not going to try and give a more formal definition here. I'm going to try and give folks an intuition for what it is. The idea is that it's a function that you can pause and resume. Right. And so you can use that to build an iterator. Right. An iterator is something where you can keep asking the producer for more data. Right. And then basically what you're saying is, hey, producer, do enough work to give me this one piece of data and then just cool it. Just chill. And I'll come back later when I want some more data. Well, that in its heart could be implemented with this concept of a function that you can kind of start and then stop and then resume later on.
Mm-hmm.
Async await is another thing that you can build on this concept of coroutines. And the idea here is, look, I have a function. And the job of this function is to produce a promise. Right. But in the meantime, in order to produce this promise, and when you actually consume the promise, it might perform a lot of operations and in the process call other asynchronous functions itself. And what it may want to do is pause and then until some asynchronous function that this function has called has resolved to a value and then resume.
And this works because it is returning an asynchronous thing, a promise. And so therefore, it's okay for it to pause, if you will, as it builds these other things.
Yes. I mean,
is that a way of thinking about
it? Well, think about coroutines. So there's a kind of a similarity. There's an interesting similarity between the query syntax I talked about a moment ago,
yeah,
how it was general enough to be able to compose together any type, and coroutines, although they're very different in how they accomplish this, coroutines you can think of as a basic concept you can use to compose together a lot of different interesting types. One is iterators. You can use it to compose together an iterator, but you can also use it to compose together promises and functions which produce promises.
Mm-hmm.
You can use it to compose together observables. And in general, you want to use it for things where it makes sense. You want to be able to use control flow, but then like concepts like while loops and try catch, and then sort of pause right in the middle and then resume. It's a really kind of magical seeming thing. Under the hood, all that happens, if you look, and you actually, I advise developers to take a look at this themselves.
The
go try the Babel Babel implementation of generators.
This is Babel basically is a transformation layer that will take new syntax and convert it into old syntax to run on environments that don't support the new syntax. And therefore, it has to produce traditional JavaScript code, if you will.
That's correct. And so when you look at the ES5 code that gets generated, what you'll see is actually just a while loop with a switch statement. And every single time, and it matches one of, say, n possible cases. And then as soon as you execute the logic for that one case, it breaks. And that's effectively how they simulate a go-to, right? And so
okay,
the idea is, because there are only so many places in your function which may suspend, you can say that I'm going to break up this function in actually four possible cases. When the function's triggered again, it's going to be in one of four, say,
right,
states.
I see.
And it's essentially turning what looks like a function with control flow concepts into a state machine. So
yeah,
it's all compiler
yeah
magic.
Right. And the thing that's interesting about that state machine, though, is it's embedded in the language and so that it has no – you know, the problem with state machines is when you get out of sync or when you're doing things where you have errors in them, right? So this is putting that kind of state machine under the hood at a level which is fundamentally trustable. You don't have to implement yourself.
Yeah, I would say it's less about errors. It's just more that, frankly, expressing state machines sucks. It's not fun, right? It's what you – and very often there are – and there, it turns out there's a lot of different ways in which you can write code where, you know, it's much more readable to human beings,
yeah,
right? And then compile them into state machines.
Yeah.
And generators
and
are just
what,
one example.
That's what language enhancements are for, right? It's for us. It's not for the computers.
Yeah.
It's for us to be able to understand things at a more rich level. So async await is in 2016, yeah?
It's 2017.
2017,
yes.
Okay. So what TC39 has started to do now is you're releasing a new JavaScript baseline every year. Instead of having like ES5 and ES6, which is their earlier versions, now there's kind of yearly releases.
Yeah, I mean, I really want to emphasize – I just don't think this matters to the average developer.
Yeah.
I'd like to get to away from the point of developers talking about ES2016, ES2017. In the end, these features can make it into a browser long before they're standardized,
yeah,
and probably should.
Yeah.
What
are some exciting features that are coming along? Don't name numbers and stuff. What are you excited about? Looks like it's going to be ratified and accepted.
Well, so some of the stuff that I'm most excited about is very, very early in the pipeline. So for the caveat that, you know, anything I talk about now, I mean extremely early, like things that are stage one. But I'm excited about them because developers have these pain points. They try legitimately to address pain points developers have. And many cases
– async await was definitely a response to a pain point. So,
oh, yeah. Absolutely, right? And that's really what the committee calls paving the cow path here. I guess it's not always – can sound less than complimentary, but the intention here is that if developers are doing something, let's go ahead and make the thing that they're doing easier. And
yeah,
so we should be driven by one of the ways in which we find this out is if, you know, there are proposals and we find a lot of usage of the Babel plugins, for example.
Right. Or promises is a perfect example of that. Promises emerged from people using them and they
yep
being really functional. Now they're in the language.
Yeah, they yeah came out of the community and the JavaScript makes, you know, pretty big tries very hard to make it work with the large set of libraries out there, the popular libraries, the
yeah
promise libraries out there. It's actually kind of designed to work with promises that aren't just native promises that you create in JavaScript, but a promise created by a third-party library trying to integrate with that. So anything with a then method, for example, you
yes
know, you can perform certain operations on.
Mm-hmm.
And so one area where I think personally, I think that there's a pain point here, and I'm not the champion of any of these proposals, but I know some of the folks who are, and it's certainly stuff that affects us here at Netflix, partly because we do so much work with observables, is that while JavaScript is kind of often referred to as a hybrid functional program or multi-paradigm language, right?
Yes.
It's multi-paradigm, but it's object-oriented first. Or, you know, I think it's fair to say that, you know, there's a lot of the language pushes the Turing model and mutation. Mutation's pervasive in JavaScript, and you're thinking about things in terms of objects quite a bit. There's a lot of incentive for you to think about things in terms of object. There's performance advantages,
sure,
for example, to using prototypes to store state instead of capturing state enclosures, and there has been for a while. Hopefully that those disadvantages, the hit we get, and that's actually improving. Modern VMs are getting better and better at optimizing functional patterns. But the reality is, I would think it's fair to say JavaScript is a object-oriented programming language first, and then anything else as a secondary.
Yeah.
And so as people are now using more and more functional programming in JavaScript, and part of that has to do with React, part of that has to do with functional programming just in general becoming more tractable for solving a range of problems in the industry. And what you see is, particularly when you have full stack devs, right? Somebody is using functional programming to coordinate events on the server. They'll take those concepts back to the UI.
Yeah.
And just as often you see the other thing where a UI developer has been using functional programming concepts like observable to coordinate concurrency on the UI. And then they start writing Node scripts and they say, hey, wait a second. I mean, I can either do this exactly or something very similar over here. I think that's why you're starting to see functional programming expand, because it's really great for certain types of very hard problems, or at least
what's this new stuff that's supporting functional programming in JavaScript? What's the new things that he's learning?
I got off on a tear there. One thing that I'm very excited about is the pipeline operator. So the pipeline operator, if anyone who has used, or let's say the array methods, for example. So I can go array.map.filter.scan and I can chain. And because a method is on the prototype, it's on the this object prototype, you can kind of chain and write left to right, so that this is really a question of ergonomics. This isn't enabling something you can't do now. It's really just making it more ergonomic and possibly, you know, improving performance.
Mm-hmm.
So right now we write code left to right, which is the way in which we read. The operations execute left to right if you're chaining dot map dot filter, for example. But array comes with batteries included. It ships in the browser, so it has all of these helpful methods. It could have more things like lodash and underscore add them. So it's very straightforward to do that kind of chaining because all that stuff's sitting on the prototype.
Oh, because it's always there the whole time.
Right, but
that
now
it always has to be there.
It always has to be there, and that's harder when you're pulling in third-party libraries.
Mm-hmm.
What if I want to – I mean, right now we can see this with underscore. Let's say I want to – there's a huge number of possible operations that you could execute on an array, only some subset of which has been blessed by JavaScript and put on the prototype. So in order to write in this literal style, we basically have two options. One is if you can now have a bunch of functions that you pull in from Lodash, and ideally you pull them in only the ones that you're using, right?
Okay.
So this is why it's not ideal to have a single object with all of these objects, with all these methods on the prototype, because then in order to call them left to right, you actually have to mutate the prototype and add them.
Right, right.
And this doesn't play well.
This is what Lodash is doing, of course.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, there's another pattern.
Yeah.
Well, there's another pattern, which is, I think, just painful as well, which is you can adapt into the Lodash type, whatever. So you can say, hey, take the array, turn it into the Lodash type.
Oh, right.
And now you have access to all of Lodash's methods. But then again, they've all got to be there on the prototype object. And if you use only two of them, you can't kind of pull them in. And so mm-hmm. we want tree shaking. We want build tools that actually just pull in the bits that we use. But when you're mutating prototypes, it can be difficult for the build tool to figure out exactly what's needed and what's not needed. And so this is kind of the why we're disadvantaged, because if you were to do this in the more functional style, you would just have the first argument of every function be the thing it's operating on. The problem is that then the code reads right to left, right? You could think about, I'm going to pass the array into the filter method, but then I'm going to pass the result of the filter method into the map. And then if you imagine what that reads like, it reads like
it looks
map
like a pyramid
filter
kind of thing. It's
right,
like
but
all
it's actually
right.
actually executing filter map, not map filter,
mm-hmm.
right? So the pipeline operator solves this problem in a very simple and elegant way. It just says, look, whatever's on the left-hand side of this little – by the way, it looks like a pipe and then the smaller than HTML bracket, the larger than HTML bracket. So a little triangle. And whatever's on the left-hand side just passes the first argument to whatever function's on the right-hand side. And so now once again,
so you're
can
just
go –
effectively flipping that – read right to left to right.
That's all it is.
The object does, so that you can read it easier.
Yeah,
now
you could
go. It looks
like
a little arrow pointing over.
Yeah, it does look like a little arrow saying, and kind of trying to visually, from an ergonomic standpoint, it's trying to indicate, hey, data is flowing from here into here. So I'm taking this observable on the left hand side, or this array on the left hand side, and I'm piping it into to Lodash's first method.
Okay,
right?
Cool. So this is called the pipe method.
The pipeline operator.
And pipeline operator is going to be available if the ratification works, everybody seems to like it, and it starts to be implemented. So it's a long road. It's early.
Yes, very, very early. I was just kind of presented.
Jaffer, I knew that we would fill up an hour easily, and we certainly did. And thank you so much for chatting with me about your career and about programming paradigms, and also about JavaScript's some new features that are exciting and coming forward. I really appreciate it. Thank you
very much.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we made it. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'll see you next week here on GeekSpeak. Thank you so much.